You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
This week's podcast, we're going to take a look at what the teams have done during the offseason now that pitchers and catchers are just days away from reporting to spring training. I am Allison Footer from MLB.com, and I talk to the NL East reporters about what their teams did and what they should be looking for entering spring training. Anthony, I have to ask you the obvious question, because the first thing is, like, what was their most impactful signing? Obviously, we know what that was. But go ahead and tell us who the Mets were targeting and hoping to get and got in the end.
Well, it's a guy not a lot of people have heard about. His name is Yoenis, I think, Cespedes. It's really interesting when you look back at the Mets offseason, because it was an offseason full of hand-wringing and the fan base not revolting, but maybe coming close to that stage, because they really weren't happy with anything. Moves to get better. No one seemed to think it was enough. And then all of a sudden they signed Yoenis Cespedes, the pipe dream that everyone wanted. And now you look at them on paper and they're World Series favorites and everything is peachy keen. And it's just a total 180 from where the team was before Cespedes came back. So on the field, on paper, he just makes everything around him better. If the Mets were going to camp right now and hadn't signed him and were just going with what they had before that, you would be reading story after story in every newspaper about how did this team do enough? Is this team good enough? Are they worse from the team? Are they worse than the team that made the playoffs, that made the World Series last year? Now, all the storylines are going to be, how good is this team? Can they repeat? Can they get back to the World Series? Can they win it this time? The sky is the limit, and so on and so forth. One guy did all of that. One guy in reputation alone, and it's a well-deserved reputation because he's obviously a great player, but just the mood around the team is a total 180 since they signed this guy, and we'll see how it plays on the field.
Yeah, so, I mean, the devil's advocate would say, like, it's dangerous for a team coming off of a World Series appearance to not make that many changes, just try to stick with the same players that never works out the year after. And, you know, of course, and like you say, I mean, we're kind of chuckling at just, like, the reactions of fans and media for whatever. I mean, you're immediately looking at something to be mad at. You know, other people say, well, the Mets, they don't make any moves. And they're keeping for, you know, fiscal reasons and this and that. But, I mean, when you break down, like, some of the moves that they did make besides the Cespedes, I mean, it's really not too bad. I mean, you have to like this Neil Walker deal, right? I mean, that's a legitimate infielder that can bring kind of a veteran presence. So, I mean, how much tweaking beyond that was really needed?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, and that's the thing, is the moves that they made beyond Cespedes, I think across the board were pretty good ones. It's just none of them were splashy. You mentioned Neil Walker. I mean, I was reading Jim Duquette's column on MLB.com just the other day, and he ranked it one of the five best deals in the game this winter. And it's a sneaky good one, because you get better offensively and defensively at second base, and you essentially gave up a guy that you weren't going to use in John Neese to get him. So it was that was a really good deal for them. I think they got a lot better in the bullpen, at least more consistent. They have that veteran presence now with Antonio Bastardo. Jerry Blevins is coming back. And, you know, they retained Addison Reed. So those three guys in front of Jiris Familia, you have to think, even if, you know, it doesn't all work out like you want, you have to think one or two of those guys is going to be pretty good, and you'll have a pretty solid back end of the bullpen, which they didn't always have at times last year and in previous years. And then the other thing is, you've got these starting pitchers now who are essentially going to be no longer, we're going to be talking about innings limits, anything like that. They're all a year older. They're all a year more mature. They all are a year closer to essentially being in their primes. I would say Jacob deGrom is smack in the middle of his prime now. Right now, you've got Matt Harvey, who is an extra year removed from surgery, and you have to think that if nothing else, he can be more consistent. You've got Noah Syndergaard, who will be entering his first full season, and that's always a good thing for pitchers as they go along. Same with Steven Matz. So there's a reason to think these guys can be incrementally better. And then when you look at the bullpen being better than it was at this time last year, the lineup being worlds better than it was at this time last year, And then you take a look at the division around them, with two teams essentially in rebuilding mode. One team in the Marlins that's, you know, wants to compete, but who knows, it didn't work for them last year. And then one other team in the Nationals that the Mets sort of had their way with last year. It's hard to argue against the Mets as the division favorite right now, which is a place that this team hasn't been in a long, long time. So excitement all around, and there's reason for it.
So I guess the only really, like, question, as far as, like, huge, gigantic questions, is just how many maybe games that David Wright can play. Is that going to be something that everyone's going to have their eyes on in training? And as the season goes on, it's just keeping track of what's going on with him?
Yeah, I mean, this is, like I said, everything's sort of peachy around Mets camp right now. There are no legitimate position battles. You're looking at maybe one bench spot up for grabs. You're looking at maybe one or two spots at the back of the bullpen. But so really the things we're going to be concentrating on spring training are, A, David Wright. How does this guy look in what should be his first full year back from that spinal stenosis diagnosis? Is he the same player? Can he hit for power offensively? Can he be a good fielder defensively, which we didn't really see from him after he came back? So just what's David Wright going to look like? Because this guy's still got 5 years left on that deal that he signed, and the Mets really need him to produce for them. And two is going to be the health of the pitching staff. Pitching is always hard to keep healthy. The Mets have, if not the best staff in the game right now, one of the best. But they're not infallible, and a big injury to one of their top guys could change things. So it's going to be a matter for the Mets of what they do in spring training. They're going to be very cautious with a lot of these guys who are coming off of their highest workloads of their careers. They're going to push these guys back. You're not going to see Matt Harvey or Noah Syndergaard or Jacob deGrom in those first round of Grapefruit League games. You might not see them until mid-March, really, just because the Mets are going to be so cautious with them and do everything they can to keep these guys healthy. With everything they did to their offense, to their bullpen, the rotation is still their bread and butter. It's going to be the reason they make it or not this year. So that to me is the big storyline coming into spring training, what they do and how these guys look coming off those workloads. Are they going to be as dynamic? Are they going to continue to be the best staff in the game?
Yeah, because that has to be worrisome. It's nothing that anybody's ever going to verbalize. But the extra innings, I mean, this World Series went to, what, November 2nd? I mean, there's, like, I know Tom Verducci has spent a lot of time just, like, studying what happens to a pitcher who, you know, pitches deep into October, what happens in the following season. So in the back of everyone's mind, I guess that's got to be concerning, no matter, and not just with Matt Harvey, but just, like, with everybody, because of how hard they throw and because of how long they pitched last year.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, for two reasons. One is the injury risk, and probably the guy you worry about most is Noah Syndergaard, because he's the only one of those young pitchers who hasn't had Tommy John surgery. And I've mentioned this in the past, and you know, Mets fans sort of go ooh and start booing when you mention Noah Syndergaard's name and Tommy John surgery in the same sentence. And I'm certainly not saying that it's a given, but it has to be in the back of your mind that you got to take care of this guy, because you never know. Matt Harvey coming off surgery, I mean, it was a big story last year, the amount of innings that he threw, and now how is he going to bounce back from that? Is it going to continue to be that smooth sailing linear progression back from Tommy John surgery, or are all those innings piled up going to do something, you know, to hurt him? And we're not even talking necessarily about injuries with these guys. We're talking about effectiveness. Will they be as dynamic? We saw down the stretch and in the playoffs with Jacob deGrom last year, he was fatigued. He was quite obviously fatigued to everyone who was watching him. And when they backed off him, when they had the luxury of doing so at the end of September, and then again between rounds of the playoffs, and he came back with extra rest, he looked completely dynamic and like a completely different guy. So is coming off that workload this offseason going to be long enough for him to sustain that for a full six-month season? And if the Mets have their way, it's much longer than 6 months. These are all questions that I don't have the answer to, that the Mets don't have the answer to, that the pitchers themselves don't have the answer to. But we're just going to have to report to camp like everyone else and see how these guys are throwing and see how they look against live hitting when they start facing it again. And something, honestly, we're going to be monitoring for the bulk of the summer as we go through. Will these guys be the same in April as they are in June and July and August and September? We don't know. But the Mets need them to be, so it's definitely something to watch as we go forward here.
So there's about a week
to go until pitchers and catchers report for spring training, which is so exciting. So we want to take this time to look back and kind of review what the team did. So when you just kind of take in what the Nationals did this offseason, do you feel like it was enough, like it was not enough? Obviously, this is not a team that needed a whole lot of talent tweaking, perhaps just maybe some different leadership, which they addressed. But just as far as, like, the player personnel, do you see that they did enough?
Well, I'm in between, Allison. Obviously, they needed to fix their starting lineup, and they needed more lefties in that lineup. Obviously, they did a great job getting Ben Rivera and Daniel Murphy. I think they did a great job there. I think the jury's still out as far as the bullpen. They made a lot of changes there, and by getting people like Trevor Gott, Sean Kelly. But I have to wait and see, because last year it was so bad regarding the bullpen. I just want to make sure that it's going to be a quality bullpen this year. And not only that, though, you still have questions about Papelbon. He's 35 years old. He's not the Jonathan Papelbon we saw with the Boston Red Sox. So, in my opinion, I think I'm in between. And other than that, I think everything is okay with the Nationals.
Yeah, so, I mean, there are storylines that we're going to be paying attention to. And the fact that, you know, the coaching staff and the manager are not there anymore, so it's going to be a very much a fresh start. But there are things that are going to be intriguing, such as the fact that Jonathan Papelbon and Bryce Harper are still teammates. And we all know what happened between them. So I guess that's where Dusty Baker comes in. So do you think that this is going to be a lingering issue, or you think it's just going to be addressed right away and then maybe put to rest?
Allison, this is going to be a non-issue. It really is, because, I mean, it was a non-issue really maybe a month after the incident. I mean, as you know, Papelbon and Harper made up. Harper said that he wants Papelbon around. And, you know, to me, the issue is going to be more with the fans than anything else. But as long as Papelbon gets along with his teammates, there isn't going to be a problem. All Papelbon has to do to get the fans back is save a bunch of games, strike out a bunch of guys, and he'll be okay. And to me, this is a non-issue. There'll be nothing to worry about here.
Okay. So looking at, I think this would be an interesting exercise just because of how the Nationals ended the season, which was obviously not wonderfully, and going into the season. So they've had, like we just discussed, a few tweaks here and there, largely a lot of the same team clearly coming back. So when you look at the rotation from the end of last season now going into the new season, how would you rank it? How would you grade it, I guess, going into this year?
Well, I think it's not the best as it was in the past. I mean, after Scherzer and Strasburg, I think there's a bit of a question mark here because Gio Gonzalez hasn't had a great season in 2 or 3 years. If you look at Tanner Roark, he was put in the bullpen and had his worst year as a National. And Joe Ross had a great rookie year, but the question is, you know, like he got tired towards the end. You know, can he play a full season? And also, you know, there's some good news here. You have Lucas Giolito waiting in the wings, and he is going to be in spring training this year. So that's the most exciting thing. We're going to see him. So, I think it's a wait and see, but I think the rotation is still going to be decent, above average.
And I want to ask you about Bronson Arroyo, because we both thought it would be like crazy for him to sign with the Nationals. Would there be maybe some better opportunities for him elsewhere where it wasn't going to be so difficult to break through, you know, teams that are lesser teams, we'll call them. And then he goes and signs a minor league deal with the Nationals. So is this – yeah, I have a lot of respect for the guy, and I don't want to assume things that aren't true, but it seems like he realizes he's toward the end of the road. And might want to actually win before he hangs it up and knows that he has a chance to do it with the Nationals?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, the last time we spoke about him, you know, I questioned why the Nationals would sign this guy. He's in his late 30s. He's 39 years old, coming off of Tommy John surgery. Obviously, the Nationals have a great history with Tommy John pitchers. So, obviously, they think that he has some game left. But then again, though, I would hate to see him take over a rotation spot over a Joe Ross or even a Tanner Roark. I mean, or even a Lucas Giolito. I like to see a younger guy in there. But the reason he's in there is because of Dusty Baker. He played for Dusty Baker.
Mark, let's just go over a little bit of what the Braves have done. Obviously, we know that they're focused on next year and beyond, but there are still seasons to be played. And we've had conversations that this looks like, it could be a pretty decent kind of transition season for the Braves. So when you look at what they did in the offseason, what stands out to you as some of the more poignant moves?
You know, I think this was the more surprising of the two off seasons. If we went back a year ago, when they entered the off season after 2014, and he said, okay, well, there's a reason to trade Jason Hayward. There's a reason to trade Justin Upton. Neither of them are going to re-sign after playing what would have been their final year in Atlanta. There was reason to trade Evan Gattis because you viewed him as an American League player. Okay, but when we entered this past off season, we didn't necessarily expect them to trade Andrelton Simmons and Shelby Miller, and certainly not both of them. And it started off pretty early there during the early days of the general manager's meetings when it started to leak that they were talking to teams about Andrelton Simmons. And as you mentioned, both moves did strengthen them for the future, which continued this rebuilding process. Now they've got to live with the immediate consequences. They were fortunate enough to get a Major League a veteran shortstop in Eric Ibar to fill Simmons' role, but at the same time, I see these two guys as trending in two different directions from an offensive perspective, and it goes without saying that nobody can really replace Andrelton from a defensive perspective. As for Shelby Miller, we've spoken about this on previous podcasts. You take those 200 innings out of the rotation. Yes, it's nice to have Dansby Swanson and Aaron Blair and Ender Inciarte, which you got in return for Shelby. But right now, you're going to start to, you're going to spend the next 6 months trying to fill those innings and provide some of the consistency that Shelby might have provided. So it was a very interesting offseason. And I'd say what the major difference was, we were surprised to see both of those guys move.
Yeah, so it's pretty timely as you and I are recording this. Keith Law is like 30 minutes ago released his rankings of all the farm systems of all 30 teams. He's the ESPN.com insider. Of course, he's very well respected in the industry, and he has the Atlanta Braves as the number one farm system, which comes as no surprise. He said that it's really not even close, and he really didn't have to give it that much thought. And that bodes well for, and the same thing is for our MLB pipeline guys are talking about the Braves, really being top notch. So as they enter the season, I guess it's kind of nice to know that at least.
Yeah. They have some tangible proof that other people respect your moves, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I mean, to see, Keith Law come out and say that they do have the best system. I know that our guys where we ranked them. I think we had five guys in the top 100 with MLB.com. Phillies may have had seven, but it's just the difference is the amount of guys that the Braves have there in the top 50, 60 players. Within our system, and then obviously with Keith Law, I think like you said, it was just came out a half hour ago, but. I remember breezing over and seeing something like where he was talking about the guys ranked 11th through 20th within the system per his rankings. These guys are going to have major league impact. Well, you go back a year or two ago, or let's go to the end of the 2014 season, what they had before they started making these changes. And a guy named Jason Hirsch was within their top five prospects, probably. Most everyone had him within top five. Well, right now you don't even see him within the top 20 in most of these rankings. So that gives you a sense of, he was the number one draft pick in 2000. I think that was 13. He's fallen off the board because, first of all, because he has taken a step backwards and now a relief pitcher, but at the same time, they've just filled their system with that much talent that they brought in via trades and few draft picks, and the international market is going to be very kind to them this summer again as well, because they're going to be very aggressive. Probably get the top guy. It's a bad secret. Are you a reality TV show watcher, Allison?
Just a couple, but not really.
I don't watch it. I don't watch much, but my wife's into The Bachelor. So one, I was like, why? You can already find out who the winner is, Reality Steve or whatever. Anyhow, I found this Reality Steve, and so I kind of view the international market, at least this Kevin Maiton here, the fact he's going to sign with the Braves. I think that's the only worst-kept secret is who's going to win The Bachelor every year.
The only reality show I watch is one Housewives show with Jim Edmonds' wife is one of the stars. It's like I can't tear my eyes from it. It's such a train wreck. Jim Edmonds is like, we all like Jim Edmonds. So the whole thing is just like mind boggling. Okay. So I want to, as far as like looking at what the team has done and how like the rotation is set up. When you look at this rotation, how would you, with some of the reporters we've been doing great, it's like great the rotation, great bullpen. I don't know if that we need to do that with the Braves necessarily, but with the rotation, like how do you see it as a whole? As far as depth and just guys that can give you 175 innings, getting through a major league season health. I mean, how do you see that kind of setting up?
And we'll start at the top there. We'll go with there is not going to be a lot of stability. I actually just recently wrote that the Braves rotation will have the stability and consistency of typical Marlins coaching staff this year. But I think that so there will be a lot of changes. But right there at the top, Julio Teheran, I expect him to have a better season than he did last year. Whether he gets back to where he was in 2013 and 14 remains to be seen. There's a big question mark is what does Bud Norris do coming off a year like he had last year? 2 years ago, he pitched effectively enough that he made two playoff starts for the Orioles, and then last year he gets released in July. If he pitches effective enough for the Braves, like there's a seems to be a likely reason to believe he'd be traded in July. Then all of a sudden, what you're going to do is you're going to start opening up some other slots for the Sean Newcombs and Aaron Blairs. Terrell Jenkins may make his debut earlier in the season. But as we go into camp, I'd say the three guys that I project in that rotation for sure would be Teron, Bud Norris and Matt Whistler. The last two spots, Williams Perez may slip in there. It does not look like Mike Foltynewicz will be ready to start the season. He's still recovering from the blood clot, which caused him to lose a portion of his rib there behind his shoulder back in September. So we'll have to see what Manny Banuelos, how his elbow is. There'll be some interesting storylines surrounding that rotation, but as the season goes, I think what we're going to see is once they see a chance to test some of their young guys like Newcomb and Chris Ellis and Aaron Blair, once they can test those guys, they'll take advantage of that opportunity just so they have a better idea of what their rotation might look like in 2017.
And, Joe, I'm like, every time I look at what the Marlins have done, I continue to think that things are looking pretty good for these guys. So I'm going to state the obvious here, but I want to ask you what stands out to you as the biggest offseason move that they made before heading to spring training?
Well, yeah, it'll be Wei-Yin Chen. You know, they're the free agent signing they got from Baltimore, addressed the top priority of the number, top of the rotation caliber starter guy behind Jose Fernandez. And, that's the kind of the obvious one because they said going into the offseason they're looking to address that type of need. But, another thing that kind of stood out was their patience. This has been kind of a organization that gets emotionally attached to something and reacts quickly. But they showed a lot of patience. They didn't sign Chen until after the first of the year in January. And they just kind of waited to mark it out. They kind of had a very measured, calculated plan to not, go too overboard on anything. They had their eye on the target of
you know, they really targeted Allison two starters because they weren't going to be in on Greinke or Price or those type of guys. They really targeted John Lackey and Wei-Yin Chen. Those were the two guys they looked at, and they felt they made a really competitive offer to Lackey, who obviously right in the heels of the start of the winter meetings in December opted to go to Chicago. Once he came off the board, Chen was their main guy, and this is, shouldn't get lost. You know, Chen came into the market looking at about $20 million a year, you know, whether it's 5 years, 20, getting him at right at $100 million. But that's kind of where, you know, his camp was. And Jeffrey Loria wouldn't go there, but when the Marlins were able to get that down to $16 million a year, that's when it happened, and Jeffrey signed off on it. So that was a huge decision to go into the $80 million range to get a guy of the caliber of Wei-Yin Chen to help, you know, solidify the top of that rotation.
Yeah, and that's the luxury that teams that already have that ace have. So when you just sign a Wei-Yin Chen on a team that desperately needs some kind of veteran presence or star power or, you know, somebody who can absorb all those innings, that's one thing. But when you can slide in, like I'm thinking of the Giants also, where they have Madison Bumgarner, and then right below that, now they've got Samardzija and Johnny Cueto, and that's when it makes it kind of exciting. When you can look at a depth chart, you can see an order, and you can see Jose Fernandez at the top, and then Chen goes in there, and then you're thinking, well, now that this could be pretty interesting because the rest of the rotation kind of, I mean, they've got some good names in there, and things sort of have a way of working themselves out. They seem to have a little bit of depth also, some reinforcements. That's when you really start thinking, they might have something going on here.
Yeah, because you could go into a short series, especially in the NL East, where the Mets can throw DeGrom, Harvey, or Harvey DeGrom, whatever they want to do, or even Syndergaard, and you feel you can match up at least those first two games, you know. And in a short series, you know, that matters. And I'm a big believer, if you're slotted right, you know, if you're a five but have to pitch two, you know, you're not really in your comfort zone. If that, as you noted, that helps Cole or Cozart, whoever kind of wins that number three battle, allows them to settle in without being pushed into the number two spot or number, you know, 1B if Jose has to be held back to start because of an innings limit. You know, you kind of put people in positions best to succeed. So, you know, that was a really big signing for him, for the team to get him, because they were really identified. Plus, he's a left-hander. This has been a rotation that's been predominantly right-handed for a long time. You know, and you get a guy who's a 200-inning guy who pitched to a low 3 ERA in the American League East and pitched in Baltimore, a hitter's park, and still was able to get those kind of numbers. There's a lot of positives there. But, you know, that was one of those who kind of quietly, you know, stayed in on him. I think we addressed this before. I'm still a little shocked that no one else was as heavily in on him. Maybe they had their reasons, and maybe they just did a really good sales job, too. But they got their guy, and kind of that was the feather of their offseason.
So looking kind of around the field a little bit, and the Marlins have a nice core of players to build around, and they made some savvy signings that did not jump off the pages or whatever we call that in the internet world, but certainly guys that will have a lot to offer or something to offer. Edward Jackson, Chris Johnson, third base. So those are sort of some of the more minor signings that could also impact a team. And how do you kind of see those two?
Yeah, first of all, with Chris Johnson, it was a good signing for them. They were looking for that right-handed bat, the guy that could play first base in a platoon-type situation with Justin Bour, if Bour, you know, shows he can't hit left-handed pitching. And, you know, they were looking at Jeff Francoeur and why they went with Chris Johnson is he has played some first base. He also gives him the luxury to go over and play some third base because Martin Prado is going to need some rest. You know, he's a highly productive player, but his playing time's got to kind of be monitored, and they got to, you know, to get best use out of him. So, you know, getting Chris Johnson, real valuable pickup there to get that, you know, right-handed bat off the bench, platoon guy at first, hit guy, a guy who's posted some good numbers. Obviously, I think he hits like .315 against left-handed pitching, so I'm sure that's, you know, going to be his forte, getting in there as often as possible against lefties. And that was just a good, solid pickup for him. And you mentioned Edwin Jackson.
the new Marlins pitching vice president of pitching development, Jim Benedict, who they got from the Pirates in the offseason, he had really had his eye on Edwin Jackson for a while. He liked him. He liked, you know, seeing, you know, what he thought Edwin had done in other parts of his career. And when the possibility came to get Edwin Jackson, it was at Jim Benedict's recommendation that this deal get done. And now it's going to be real curious to see what Jim can do to, you know, working with Edwin to refine a few things. And that could be a real find for him. Obviously, there's a big if there, and will it happen? We don't know. But low-risk, high-reward, capable of possible signing there. And he's going to be a guy that will be in that mix for the fourth and fifth starter spot as well.
So, Todd, you know, the question that I have to ask you is one that you already know what I'm going to ask you about. The most impactful move that the Phillies made this offseason, obviously there was a huge trade. So when you look at the players that were involved in that trade with Houston, how do you see that setting up as the team enters spring training?
Well, on paper, certainly it sets them up pretty nicely, especially because I think they're really keeping their fingers crossed that Vincent Velasquez, who was really the key piece of this trade for the Phillies, that was the guy they really wanted. I think they're really hoping that he can come out here in spring training and win that number five job in the rotation. And if he doesn't, I think Brett Oberholzer, the other guy, one of the other guys that got in the deal, I think they're hoping that he can kind of step in and take that spot. If Vincent Velasquez doesn't seem like he's quite ready for it yet. But either way, I think Oberholzer is going to be on the pitching staff one way or the other, either in the rotation or bullpen, because he's out of options. And, of course, you have Mark Appel is going to be in camp. He's going to start the season in AAA, but you know, I think they're kind of hoping that for one reason or another something clicks. But make a long story short, they really think that this trade, the Ken Giles trade, really added a lot of depth to the organization in terms of starting pitching, which was something that they really, really did not have last year. In fact, I think I looked up some numbers the other day. They had 10 pitchers make about 106 starts last season with a combined ERA of 6.19. So they had really bad starting pitching for most of the year. So I think they expect it. They're not expecting Velasquez to go out there and put up an ERA of 2.5 or Oberholzer or whatever. Just give them something competent. Give them some competent starting pitching. Make some improvements as the season goes on, and they expect they'll see some improvement with their record.
So to make sure that I have this right, there is a very good chance that the starting five, when the team rosters are set on opening day, the starting five pitchers were not with the Phillies last year. Do I have that right?
Well, yeah, to start the season last year, for sure.
Okay.
You know, Jeremy Hellickson is new. Charlie Morton is new. They got them in trades. And then Aaron Nola and Jared Eichhoff came up mid-season to late in the season. So, and then, like I said, Velasquez, I think I would call him the favorite for that number five spot going into spring training. So all five new faces compared to what was opening the 2015 season, which – like I said with that stat earlier, 10 pitchers last year with a combined 6.19 ERA, more than, you know, 60% of their games, they needed some fresh faces.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, and everyone knows where the Phillies are and where they're headed, and they're headed in a very good direction, and you've been covering them forever, and you know their system better than anybody, and you've said that, like, they are doing the right thing. At some point, though, like, when you – give me that statistic, which is just mind-boggling. I mean, there has to be some point you just can't have guys going out there absolutely burying themselves, and they do have to play major league games, and that can wear on someone, on a group of people, if there's no, you know, light at the end of the tunnel. So I guess the tunnel light is opening a little bit more this year.
It definitely is. I think Nola and Eichhoff last year, I think they made like a combined 21 starts. And they pitched very, very well, and the team was 11-10 in those games, and that's not going to get the Phillies into the postseason or in postseason contention, but what that does tell you is just a little bit, just be competent, go out there and pitch 6 innings, 7 innings, 3-4 runs, give your team a chance to win. And even the Phillies, who had one of the worst offenses in baseball last year, ended up winning more games than they lost when those two young pitchers made starts last season. So, and that's why I think they do see a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel, because they really do think that Nola, Eichhoff, Velasquez, and some of these other prospects they have coming up through the system, those guys are going to be a heck of a lot better than what they had last year in the past couple of years. So, you know what? Like I said, they're probably not going to, I mean, they're not expected to compete for the postseason this year. They might not even finish, might not even challenge 500, but I think they're certainly expecting, with better pitching, they're going to improve upon last year's record, which was 63-99, the worst record in baseball.
Woo, 99. So, yeah. Looking ahead a little bit, I mean, when do you see? Maybe this is not a fair question, but when can you foresee like things really coming together where they are actually just contenders and not, you know, hoping to surprise people or hoping just to break 500? But when is this whole plan? It's going to take 2 years? Is it going to take 3 years? Is it more than that?
You know, I think if everything goes as they expect, and what I mean by that is they're not expecting all of these prospects that they have to all of them pan out and all of them be solid big league contributors, but a decent share of the prospects that they have coming up through the system. I think what would be realistic is the Phillies improve a little bit this season. You know, I don't know what record that would be. You know, maybe, you know, a few games under 500. Maybe then by 2017, you know, they're a 500 team or maybe a little bit better. And then by 2018, you know, they really start to compete again. And I think nobody with the Phillies is saying it, but I think that would be a fair guess or gauge on when they think they will be a competitive team again. When I think they will start, you know, kind of dipping back into that free agent market and making some big splashy signings. But hey, you know what? We've seen other teams really turn it around a lot quicker than a lot of other people expected, and same could happen to the Phillies. But I think 2018 is probably a realistic guess on when things get better for them.